Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayanam Namaskritya. Naram Chaiva Narottamam. Devim Saraswatim Vyasam. Tito Jayam Udirayen. Nasta Prayeshvabhadreshu. Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya. Bhagavati Uttama Shloke. Bhaktir Bhavati Naishtiki. We're reading this morning from chapter 11 of the first canto, starting on verse 11. We're going to read all the translations through verse 27, part of the chapter here. So if you would be so kind, let's everyone read one translation, pass it around, and then we'll go back and focus on one of the verses. That's page 206 in this edition, verse 11, chapter 11.
Okay.
Who would like to start? Lakshmi, will you start, please?
As Bhogavati, the capital of Nagaloka, is protected by the Nagas, so was Dwaraka protected by the descendants of Vrishni, Bhoja, Madhu, Dasharha, Arha, Kukura, Andaka, etc., who were as strong as Lord Krishna.
Okay, this is verse 11 in chapter 11.
Okay, the city of Dwarkapuri was filled with the opulence of all seasons. There were hermitages, orchids, flower gardens, parks, and reservoir of water breeding lotus flower all over.
The city gateway, the household doors, and festooned arches along the roads were all nicely decorated with festive signs like plantain trees and mango leaves, all to welcome the Lord. Flags, garlands, and painted signs and slogans all combined to shade the sunshine.
The highways, subways, lanes, markets, public meeting places were all thoroughly cleansed and then moistened with scented water. And to welcome the Lord, fruits, flowers, and unbroken seeds were strewn everywhere.
In each and every door of the residential houses, auspicious things like curd, unbroken fruits, sugar cane, and full water pots with articles for worship, incense, and candles were all displayed.
On hearing that most dear Krishna was approaching Dwarkadham, magnanimous Vasudeva, Krura, Urgasena, Balaram, the superhumanly powerful, Pradumna, Charudeshna, and Samba, the son of Jambavati, all extremely happy, abandoned resting, sitting, and dining.
They hastened toward the Lord on chariots with Brahmins bearing flowers. Before them were elephants, emblems of good fortune. Conch shells and bugles were sounded, and Vedic hymns were chanted. Thus they offered their respects, which were saturated with affection.
At the same time, many hundreds of well-known prostitutes began to proceed on various vehicles. They were all very eager to meet the Lord, and their beautiful faces were decorated with dazzling earrings, which enhanced the beauty of their foreheads.
Expert dramatists, artists, dancers, singers, historians, genealogists, and learned speakers all gave their respective contributions, being inspired by the superhuman pastimes of the Lord. Thus they proceeded on and on.
Lord Krishna, the personality of Godhead, approached them and offered due honor and respect to each and every one of the friends, relatives, citizens, and all others who came to receive and welcome him.
The Almighty Lord greeted everyone present by bowing his head, exchanging greetings, embracing, shaking hands, looking and smiling, giving assurances and awarding benedictions, even to the lowest in rank.
Then the Lord personally entered the city, accompanied by elderly relatives and invalid Brahmanas with their wives, all offering benedictions and singing the glories of the Lord. Others also praised the glories of the Lord.
When Lord Krishna passed over the public roads, all the ladies from respectable families of Dwarka went up to the roofs of their palaces just to have a look at the Lord. They considered this to be the greatest festival.
The inhabitants of Dwarka were regularly accustomed to look upon the reservoir of all beauty, the infallible Lord, yet they were never satisfied.
Satiated.
Sorry.
The Lord's chest is the abode of the goddess of fortune. His moon-like face is the drinking vessel for eyes, which hanker after all that is beautiful. His arms are the resting places for the administrative demigods, and his lotus feet are the refuge of pure devotees who never talk or sing of any subject except his lordship. In the last verse.
As the Lord passed along the public road of Dwarka, his head was protected from the sunshine by a white umbrella. White feather fans moved in semicircles and showers of flowers fell upon the ground. His yellow garments and garlands of flowers made it appear as if a dark cloud was surrounded simultaneously by the sun, moon, lightning, and rainbows.
All right, so we covered a lot there, and there are some wonderful sections. His Holiness Bhakti Marg Maharaj will speak on verse 28 on Wednesday. So, in this section, Krishna is entering Dwarka. So, who knows the meaning of that word, Dwarka, the name? Say door or gate, yes. Right. So, it's on the west coast of India, facing which body of water? Any geography? Yes, Indian Sea. And there is a historical tradition that people from that part of India are in every village of the earth. Gujaratis, yes. There's a Gujarati in every village of the earth. And they own a Motel 6 there. This is traditional, the seafaring part of India. So Dwarka is on the coast of India, and it's like the lost city of Atlantis. It is sometimes considered to be that lost city because it was built in the sea, and then it disappeared from view after Krishna's departure. So Krishna is said to, in the Nectar Devotion, that his pastimes are perfect in Mathura, more perfect in Dwarka, and most perfect in Vrindavan. So perfect is one of those adjectives that is an absolute and does not need an adverb to modify it, like unique, as in the phrase, like totally unique. Like totally is like totally unnecessary, because something is either unique or it's not unique, right? Unique means one of a kind. So perfect means there's no more room for improvement. And yet, in Krishna, this contradiction is resolved. His pastimes are perfect in Mathura and more perfect in Dwarka, but most perfect in Vrindavan. So how did Dwarka come to be built? Oh, one thing I was going to mention, by the way. Does anyone here need proof that they're not perfect? Okay, then you can try this. Try making your right toe go in a clockwise motion, okay? All right, not too hard. Okay, now while doing that, with your right hand, sketch a figure 6 in the air. Okay, what happened? Yeah, or you're completely just wired to do that. You know, you can't. So, just in case anyone needed any proof. Let's see. Twirl the bell and ring the incense, right? So So Krishna was in Vrindavan with his loving relationships with all the residents of Vrindavan when who came to take him to Mathura? Akrura, in order to, yes, to wrestle Kamsa's wrestlers, etc. So he ended up killing Kamsa, leaving Kamsa's family without a head. So two of his Kamsa's wives, Asti and Prapti, were daughters of Jarasandha. Yes, Jarasandha was the child of a very powerful family who had been born in two halves, and the family just discarded him in the jungle. So there, a witch named Jara found the two pieces, put them together, and raised him. So he was known as Jarasandha, one who was joined by Jara. And he was extremely powerful and wicked. So when his two daughters were widowed by Krishna killing Kamsa, they came to him for shelter. And he was very angry at Krishna for having done this. So he raised an army and attacked Mathura. Now, who can say the reason from Bhagavad Gita why Krishna descended on the earth? Bina shaya chaduskritam dharma samstapanartaya sambhavam yuge yuge. In order to establish the pious and to annihilate the miscreants. So this was his very purpose. If you remember, when the earth was overburdened and went to the demigods, and the demigods went to Lord Vishnu, please relieve the burden of the earth, all these unnecessary armies. So here was an opportunity for Krishna to fulfill his purpose. So when Jarasandha attacked, Krishna and a very small band of troops came out of Mathura and killed all of them. This huge army. And they captured Jarasandha. Krishna didn't lose a single soldier. But all of Jarasandha's soldiers were killed. And they had captured Jarasandha, but Krishna said, no, let him go. So Jarasandha went back and raised another army and again attacked. Because demons are a little slow to get it. So again, he raised an army and attacked, and Krishna killed them, and again, 17 times, 16 times, he attacked. The next time, Krishna realized that there was another demon by the name of Kalayavana who was planning to attack from the opposite direction. So he said to Balaram, this is such a hassle. How can we protect Mathura from both sides? So we should make a safe place where the residents of Mathura can live in peace without all this warfare. So he told Balaram, don't worry, I'll take care of it tonight. So he manifested a city in the middle of the sea, or surrounded by the sea, not in the middle, but on the coast, off the coast of Gujarat, 100 square miles. And the Sukadeva Goswami comments at this point that you and I would not be able to float a single stone, but Krishna floated this island. But he floats big planets in outer space, so this really wasn't very much for him. And on that 100 square miles, the demigods came, headed by Vishvakarma, the architect, and designed the perfect city. It had long, broad, straight roads, full of parks everywhere. Everything was very nicely landscaped. These descriptions that we read about how the citizens decorated every home with auspicious articles. They were all very opulent. All of the houses had stables that were made of brass. There were festoons, arches everywhere. It was an absolutely glorious and perfect city, especially on the quarter where Lord Krishna's palaces were located. So this opulent city of Dwarka was created overnight. The gods brought various offerings to embellish its beauty. Lord Indra brought a Parijata tree. Varuna brought gifts, special gifts. So in this way, the city was all set up. The residents of Mathura went to sleep in Mathura, and they woke up in their new quarters in Dwarka. They said, oh, this is nice. They had no idea what had happened. But In this way, Krishna created Dwarka as an impregnable fort. One of the demigods, I believe it was Varuna, contributed the Sudharma meeting hall as a central meeting place in Dwarka. And it's described that anyone who entered that building would be relieved of all disease, all anxiety, old age, and even death. So just by going to work there in this meeting hall every day, all of the residents of Dwarka were blessed with opulence. And yet, in spite of this, later in the 10th canto, we read how politics and intrigue entered Dwarka, and eventually the residents all killed each other. Because after everyone else was annihilated, they became the most powerful army on earth. No one could defeat them. So, by Krishna's arrangement, they all got in a fratricidal war and killed each other. But that is later in the 11th canto. But all this is described in the 10th canto. So there at Dwarka, Krishna created this absolute ideal city. So if in verse 12 that we just read, I'd like to go back, read the verse again, and study the purport in more detail. Let's chant the Sanskrit, shall we? Sarvartu Sarvavibhava Punya Briksha Latasramai Udyano Pavanamar Vanaramayar Britta Padma Karasriyam Sarvartu Sarvavibhava Punya Briksha Latasramai Udyano Pavanama Ramayar Pavana Ramayar Ritta Padma Karasriyam. Please chant. Vibhava. Sarvartu Sarvavibhava. Punya Vriksha Latakshramai. Udyano Pavanaramayar. Brahmsyam. Sarva Ritu Sarva Vibhava. Punya Diksha Latakshamai. Udyano Pavana Ramayar Vritta Padma Parasriyam Sarvatu Sarva Vibhava Punya Vriksha Latakshamai Udyano Pavana Ramayar Vritta Padma Karasriyam Sarvartu Sarvavibhava Punya Vriksha Latakshramai Udyano Pavana Ramayar Vritta Padma Karasriyam Sarva, all, Ritu, seasons, Sarva, all, Vibhava, opulences, Punya, pious, Briksha, trees, Lata, creepers, Ashramai, with hermitages, Udyana, orchards, Upavana, flower gardens, Aramai, pleasure gardens and beautiful parks. Vritta, surrounded by Padma Akara, the birthplaces of lotuses, or nice reservoirs of water. Shriyam, increasing the beauty. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. The city of Dwarka Puri was filled with the opulences of all seasons. There were hermitages, orchards, flower gardens, parks, and reservoirs of water, breeding lotus flowers all over. Would you like to read purport?
Perfection of the human civilization is made possible by utilizing the gifts of nature in their own way. As we find herewith in this description of this opulence, Dwarka was surrounded by flower gardens and fruit orchards along with reservoirs of water and growing lotuses. There is no mention of mills and factories supported by slaughterhouses, which are the necessary paraphernalia of the modern metropolis. The propensity to utilize nature's own gifts is still there, even in the heart of modern civilized man. The leaders of the modern civilization select their own residential quarters in a place where there are such naturally beautiful gardens and reservoirs of water. But they leave the common men to reside in congested areas without any parks and gardens. Herein, of course, we find a different description of the city of Dwarka. It is understood that the whole dhamma, or residential quarter, was surrounded by such gardens and parks with reservoirs of water where lotuses grow.
It is understood that all the peoples dependent on nature's gift of fruits and flower, without industrial enterprises promoting filthy huts and slums for residential quarters. Advancement of civilization is estimated not on the growth of mills and factories to deteriorate the finer instinct of the human beings, but on developing the potent spiritual instinct of human beings and giving them a chance to go back to Godhead. Development of factories and mills is called ugra karma, or pungent activities, and such activities deteriorate the finer sentiments of the human being and society to form a dungeon of demons.
We find herein the mention of pious trees which produce seasonal flowers and fruits. The impious trees are useless jungles only, and they can only be used to supply fuels. In the modern civilization, such impious trees are planted on the sides of roads. Human energy should be properly utilized in developing the finer senses for spiritual understanding, in which lies the solution of life. Fruits, flowers, beautiful gardens, parks, and reservoirs of water, with ducks and swans playing in the midst of lotus flowers, and cows giving sufficient milk and butter, are essential for developing the finer tissues of the human body. As against this, the dungeons of mines, factories, and workshops develop demoniac propensities in the working class. The vested interests flourish at the cost of the working class, and consequently, there are severe clashes between them in so many ways. The description of Dwarka Dham is the ideal of human civilization.
The ideal of human civilization is that everyone is provided the necessities of a happy life without disregarding their individual natures and propensities. So there are similarities for us all. We all have the requirements of our basic physical needs. But psychologically, we need to live in an environment where we can be peaceful and in tune with nature. Maybe you have this experience also of if you get stressed, if you go out for a walk in the woods or walk in the park, how quickly and easily that dissipates stress and anxiety. So the idea is to live in an environment like that where stress and anxiety never arise. There is plenty of land for this purpose. On earth, there's plenty of wealth for this purpose. But what is lacking is a will to care for others sufficiently. And the experience or the understanding about how people can actually live in a happy way. You remember the London School of Economics conducted this happiness survey and discovered that Bangladesh was the happiest country in the world. And, of course, Bangladesh is materially so miserable that people immigrate there to West Bengal for the economic opportunity. Financially, it's destitute, and it's subject to terrible monsoons and floods. And yet, people there were more satisfied than in the well-developed European and North American countries, because they had their basic needs met and lived in an environment that was more in tune with nature. So we can learn from that. As Srila Prabhupada very astutely points out in the purport, the leaders of a capitalist society always make sure that they live in a nice natural environment. Right? Now, remember this purport is being written in 1962-63, and it's in the backdrop, in the context of a new generation of Indian leaders trying to modernize and urbanize the country. Gandhi was a great advocate of the village life, and Prabhupada, as his follower, also imbued these values. Gandhi insisted that the strength of India was in its villages, and because people could be self-sufficient and they were living close with nature. If you have the chance to visit a village in India, you will see this for yourself. The houses are made from indigenous ingredients. Straw and mud are very well attuned to the climate. They can create warmth in the winter and shelter, and at the same time be cool in the summer. The ground is just bare earth, but it's spotlessly clean, and they coat it with cow dung to disinfect. And so it develops this hard, very clean surface that's swept daily with little brooms made of straw and bundled together that are very effective. Everything is just created locally. Even the satellite dish is bought at the local village store. Their bodies develop immunities to the bacteria. They basically live a fairly healthy life. It's a very charming scene, very peaceful. In Mayapur, there's a japa walk you can take from the temple that takes you through some back roads through some of these villages. And everything is just so sattvic and pleasant, very appealing. So for us, urbanites, we try to get away a few times a year and go out and camp in nature. We take a major vehicle with us, you know, with all kinds of equipment, paraphernalia, right? You know, all kinds of food supplies, emergency first aid supplies, mosquito repellent, generator to produce electricity. We even have to carry our wood in to burn. We have bodies that are dependent on an urban environment. So when devotees have tried to make this transition to live off the grid, those of you who saw Vishakha's program, she calls it a bumpy journey to harmony. It is a real transformation. Their kids grew up in that environment and loved it, flourished. But the parents really made a sacrifice to do that. The Sharanagati community is just naturally the most spectacular scenic community, farm community that we have in our Krishna conscious society. It is unbelievably gorgeous, but it's by far the harshest, also the most difficult to navigate. You know, the climate can be brutally cold in the winter, and the ground is very rocky and not very fertile. So to grow crops is difficult, but even if you manage to gather the compost and the manure and fertilize your soil and get something growing, the bears will be there to eat it just when it comes to its peak of ripeness. One of the devotees planted several apple trees, and when the bears tear down the first one, then he knows the rest are ready to be harvested. So I just bring this up because living there a few summers, which is an easy time to live there, I had the opportunity to see how these devotees have made this transition from the city, from Vancouver, up to this really off-the-grid valley. And all I can tell you is they're very hardy people to do it, and it's very difficult, very difficult. So it's a kind of a pipe dream to think that it's, I'll just live out in nature and live off the grid. For most of us, it's literally like we have a different body than the kinds that are adjusted to that environment. So if we're going to do that, we have to be prepared for many changes and austerities. At the same time, it's the greatest gift to give to your children, to raise them in an environment like that. So this is the challenge that we face in Kali Yuga. So Srila Prabhupada wanted that we would have farm communities where devotees would learn to live this way, and that they would provide milk and produce for the city temples. But he also wanted city temples. It is not that we can't experience Krishna consciousness in the city. Prabhupada quoted the poet, perhaps somebody knows who it is, city is created by man, nature is created by God. Right? So it would seem it'd be a more godly life to live out in the woods. But the difficulty is that you have no contact with conditioned souls to teach, or you have very little, limited contact with such people. And so your appreciation of Krishna consciousness can be tested. You know, that's one of the things that keeps it very sharp, is the association of non-devotees. There, but by the grace of God, go on. So, well, in one of our farm communities, the guest came, and he was saying, you don't have much contact with the outside world here, do you? And he said, no, but we're setting an example. And the guest said, well, do you ever get off your example and go out and see people? it is, in Kali Yuga, a place like Dwarka simply doesn't exist. You know, this, if you look at it, this is really the propensity that we have. We want to have the kingdom of God without God. We want to have a nice environment in which to live, mode of goodness, peaceful, clean, pure. It's a natural desire. But we're still in the material world. If we had this ideal setting, would we have much incentive to go back to Godhead? So this world is just comfortable enough so we're not absolutely unable to think and to function. And it's just uncomfortable enough so any sane person will think, I don't want to stay here indefinitely. Nonetheless, it is the duty of the government to provide these simple necessities for people. You know, people can be satisfied with very little if they're simply secure. And America has become this great leader in the world over the last couple of centuries, actually largely because of this great wealth of natural resources that the first settlers were able to exploit and create wealth. But at least idealistically or theoretically, also because of the system of government that allows people to function in relative freedom and be free to create wealth and become prosperous. Of course, they were coming from a place where this was simply not possible. If you weren't born into a family with land in much of Europe, then it was simply not possible to acquire land. It was all owned by the landed gentry, and the workers were just destined to work it and die. So here was a place where you could get land for the asking, more or less, or very inexpensively. Parts of America, like Oklahoma, were just opened up, and anyone who got there could stake a claim for 100 acres of land for free because the government wanted to settle this new territory. So in this way, Americans have a notion that the freedom to develop economically is the path to happiness. And of course, the problem with that is that in order for the Vaishyas, those who are economically astute, to develop, they have to do so at the expense of others. And this exploitation of others in the name of capitalism creates big class division. Those who are capable prosper even if the economy is bad for everybody else. Prabhupada said that is the definition of a good business person. That even if the economy is bad, they're making money. And this is factually happening around us now. That the wealthiest 1 or 2% in America have become more wealthy in the last 5 years, whereas millions of people who are formerly middle class have lost everything. So there's disparity, and this creates unhappiness and distress and all kinds of incentive for the government to provide less for the people so they can save money. See? So this is all missing the point of human life. And this is why our Krishna consciousness movement has such an important message. If you can learn to be Krishna conscious, you can be satisfied with much less. We talk about the environmental impact of vegetarianism, which is enormous. We talk about the environmental impact of oxen as opposed to tractors. Again, a huge advantage. But practically for us city folks living in Gainesville, you know, internally we learn to be satisfied with much less just by learning to be happy in Krishna consciousness. And this is a great, great benefit. Just like they make these muscle cars, 240 horsepower cars, that can go 150 miles an hour. But on the freeways of most major cities, where they're mostly driven, they can only go about 12 miles an hour because of the congestion. You know, so what is the point? You're all geared up. You can't even use what you have. So in Krishna consciousness, we learn from these basic lessons of yoga from the Bhagavad Gita that Vishaya Vinivartante, Nira Harasya Dehino, Raso Varjam Raso Pyasya, Param Drishva Nivartante. The senses will never be satisfied. They will always be hankering unless one experiences a higher taste. So like our friend, that poor young man who Joy brought in this morning, what was his name? Fernando? Yes. Yes. But it is an acquired taste, Krishna consciousness. Acquired either in this lifetime by some regular association or over many lifetimes. What is it? Yesham Twantagatam Papam. In the Gita, in the seventh chapter, Krishna says, it's the eighth chapter, seventh chapter. Yesham Twantagatam Papa, those who have acted piously in this life and in previous lives take refuge in me in devotional service. So some fortunate people are attracted to it. Some become attracted to it. Some see it and never become attracted to it due to their impiety. And or they cannot make very much progress. Just seeing a devotee assures one of a human birth in the next lifetime. Just to taste prasadam, just to hear of Krishna lunch, you know, just to see one, just to touch one of Prabhupada's books. It assures a person of a human birth and saves them from who knows how much suffering in eons of time and thousands of bodies, millions of bodies. So we're nothing but a magnanimous movement. And we're teaching this science of yoga which enables people to find happiness in materially simple circumstances. When Lord Vamandev approached Bali Maharaj, he was dressed as a little Brahmin and very innocent and attractive and pure. So Bali Maharaj, this powerful demon who had conquered the entire universe, was charmed by the young Brahmin. And he said, "Ask me for anything, I'll give you whatever you want." And Vamandev said, "Well, I just want 3 steps of land. That's all I need to lie down on." And Bali Maharaj said, "You're very naive, young man. I could give you a whole planet." And he said this very famous and important lesson, that if one's senses are uncontrolled, one can have the whole universe and still not be satisfied. So he was speaking indirectly to Bali Maharaj, who actually had the whole universe. But the point is, if one's senses are uncontrolled, there is no satisfaction. On the other hand, if one's senses are truly controlled, there's satisfaction in everything. Srila Baladeva Vibhushan has written Vishva Purna Sukhayate. Was it him or another one of our acharyas? Prabodhananda Saraswati, sorry. Prabodhananda Saraswati said, yes, Vishva Purna Sukhayate. For the Vaishnava, Vishva, the universe, Purna, is full of Sukhayate, happiness. The happiness everywhere. Because the more we progress in Krishna consciousness, the more we realize that it's completely unbustable. You know, no disaster can really shake a devotee because you expect disasters in the material world and you don't have any vested interest in the material world. We're like in the waiting room for Vaikuntha, you know. We're just here temporarily waiting for our appointment, you know, passing the time, seeing things, you know, various disasters coming by, chanting our rounds. Prabhupada used this phrase, shock after shock. Material life means shock after shock. So we're always eager to hear about the latest. Did you hear about what happened to this one? Did you hear about what happened to that one? When you get a little older, it's all about your body. Did you hear what happened to my liver? Did you hear what happened to my kid? I'm thinking as if everybody is fascinated by this subject. But one becomes so preoccupied with it. Hey, this thing is falling apart on me. I never expected this to happen. Did you hear what happened? So this is how old people pass their time. It's just not our home. This very simple foundational truth is the basis for happiness in the material world. It's funny. As long as we're looking for happiness, we'll never find it. And as soon as we accept our situation, then the happiness is everywhere. Vishva Purna Sukhayate. So any comments on this topic? Yes, Prabhu. Thank you.
I just had a realization recently, and I have so few realizations I wanted to share. But it was relevant that I have this orange bag that weighs like 35 pounds, you know? And I just realized that I haven't used anything in it for the last 5 weeks. So I've been very excited about not bringing it to Europe this time because why should I drag it up to 13 countries when I actually haven't used anything in the last 5 weeks? So what you're saying is becoming realized. Thank you.
That's funny. Prabhupada writes that even the renunciate becomes attached to his few possessions. When you become grihasthas, then one of the wonderful experiences is that of accumulation. And when you accumulate, then when it's time to move, you get to enjoy the fruits of your accumulation. Has anyone experienced this even as a single person going from place to place? Yes, why all of this stuff? This is just, again, the nature of the uncontrolled mind and uncontrolled senses. I had this very poignant experience with my mother in this visit in December. That she was an avid photographer, so she had books of photographs and slides. And after my father passed away, she was going through them and just realizing that nobody was really interested in these things. No friends, no other family members, and all of these things that she had invested so much of her life in were really of no interest to anyone but her. And she's a very intelligent lady, so she said, I'm just going to get rid of these because nobody really wants them. And I was telling her how I admired her thoughtfulness in that respect. Not that she was unappreciated, but that's just the nature of life. The things that we think are so important to us, starting with this body, you know, are really so ephemeral and superfluous. So I was also just remembering when you said that, Krishna Kripa Prabhu, I once asked a sannyasi friend if he could take a letter back to Mayapur. He was visiting in the West. Just a letter. And he said, no, I'm sorry, I have no room for it. And I thought he was just dissing me. But a friend explained to me, no, he travels. He does not check any luggage on international trips. He has one shoulder bag. And every single item that he carries has a very distinct purpose. And he does not carry anything superfluous. A little extreme, but that is. He was practicing deliberately for this purpose. Okay, other comments? Yes. Anybody? Go ahead, Prabhu, I'll repeat it. Many times we hear about controlling the senses. How does it practically translate? It's really amazing, but it's as simple as following the four principles, chanting 16 rounds, and coming to the morning program. If one does that in the right frame of mind, with the purpose of making spiritual advancement, then one's senses become controlled. It doesn't happen all at once, but over a period of time, attachments or attractions that we have to things not related to Krishna diminish. So we may have many attractions to such things, and that's okay. They don't go away by repressing them, but they go away by rigidly keeping these vows. That's all. And the other things are tolerable until we get more taste for Krishna consciousness. So as that verse I mentioned earlier indicates, yeah, but by the higher taste of spiritual life, we automatically lose the taste for lower pleasures. Rabindra Sarup Prabhu, who's older than I am even, he said, yes, I look at sex life as something for young people, like skateboarding. So that's controlling the senses just means staying in bounds with regulative principles. And then we don't have to worry. Really, I see devotees get a little over anxious about trying to stamp out desires. Especially if we're living and working and serving in an environment such as we serve. See? We cannot stamp them out. And if we try to, then we'll just get into an uncomfortable and unsustainable frame of mind. So we actually can just relax and be who we are and not pretend we're something else. If we just follow the four principles and chant 16 rounds, then come to the morning program. That's very important also. If we don't get that daily infusion of association and hearing and chanting, then it's difficult to chant 16 rounds and follow the four regular principles. Yes?
I was just thinking about what you're saying about having temples in the city and also having the importance of having these farm communities. And I was just thinking for myself, like, I mean, I really aspire to live in a self-sustainable farm community and protect mm-hmm. the cows and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, you know, but then once I do that, will I have the opportunity to preach still? And I just feel like the farm communities is such an important part of the Krishna consciousness movement for the sake of preaching, because so many people are becoming attracted mm-hmm. to going back to natural living. They're realizing that, you know, city life is actually unhealthy psychologically and you know, emotionally and physically and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like you're saying, like, our bodies are, we have different bodies. Like, our bodies need a city environment and their bodies are adapted to that. I don't know. I would have to disagree. I feel like it's not necessarily different bodies. It's just different minds. Because, like, for myself, I know I feel like the most comfortable and peaceful and able to make spiritual advancement when I'm in a farm community, whereas when I'm in the city and there's so many people and so much going on and so much sensory overload, it's more difficult for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like another aspect of the farm community is that it's so important is that it is Sankirtan. It is engaging all the living entities in the service of Krishna. It's not just you know, we're creating this ideal community, and then we become attached, and then perhaps, oh, maybe I don't want to leave this material world because it's so nice. But that's not necessarily what it is. But what it is actually protecting the cows like we should be, and not, you know, buying milk from cows that where their calves are killed, and when they're done producing, they're also killed. But protecting the cows, like it's written so many times in the scriptures that we should be doing, and protecting our own sanity, and also preaching. And I think it's definitely possible that someone could become attached to farm life and think, this is so nice, you know, maybe I don't need to leave. But I think also, really, there's really no point in having temples in the cities. I should say, there's no point in living at a temple in the city unless you're preaching.
Yes.
So that's the point. So I just feel like if you're living at a temple in the city and you're not preaching, then you're attached to the comforts of city life. Well, but similarly, if you're living at a temple in the farm and you're not preaching, but simply by living at that temple and carrying out Prabhupada's mission of Varnashram and farm life, you are preaching, because you're setting an example of this is the way society should be living.
I agree with you, with the caveat, if you can do it. First, about the point of different bodies. When Prabhupada went to Mayapur, there are many temples there. He bought land and built his first building, the Lotus Building. It was three floors of residence, and then the temple on the lower floor, very simple. And the residences were very nice for the day, for the standard. And so he got criticized by his godbrothers. Why are you doing this? And he said, because I'm bringing people from all over the world, and they will not be able to live like we Bengalis live here. And Prabhupada himself stayed in a thatched hut where we were reading about the mosquitoes, I think, the other day. I'm not sure if it was here or Dallas, I forget. But Prabhupada would, the mosquitoes were so thick that they were getting under Prabhupada's net at night. And so very difficult for Westerners to tolerate. And Prabhupada pointed this out. He said, the Westerners have a different body. So they have a different set of experiences and expectations. So I'm only referring to that. I'm not saying it's impossible to make that transition from urban to rural life. I'm just saying practically that it's an ideal in almost everyone, but a reality in very few. They're actually able to make that transition. It's expensive to live simply, for one thing, you know, because we don't have generations of people before us building up the infrastructure. So we have to go in there and buy land and set up things, and then we have to learn how to live on $200 a month rather than $2,000 a month as a minimum. You know, and for a family, that is poverty level in the United States, $2,000 a month. You know, if you're actually growing your food, actually protecting the cows, actually doing all the things that it entails, it's glorious. I completely agree with you. It's not for everybody. And it's a lot easier for people who are raised that way. That's my other point, see. So this is a gradual transition for most people. Your point is exactly right. And Prabhupada said that if we could have ideal farming villages, that millions of people would want to join. They'd want to come there and live, just for the very reasons you're saying. Seeing what an urban hell they're living in. It's just a very slow process. Most of the devotees are able to spend a few years at most directly spreading Krishna consciousness, and then become heavily involved in family responsibilities. And that may be in the city or in the country. It doesn't matter. If you make your home into a temple, then even if you're not doing a lot of direct outreach, or even if you're not farming, still you can live a Krishna conscious life. See, there really is no material restriction.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I just read about Maharaj Ambarish. I was talking with Dujamani about this yesterday. We had a really nice discussion, and about, you know, how he engaged his eyes and his ears and all his different senses that went through, you know, in the service of Krishna. You know, it's like his eyes in looking at Krishna and all these things, and taking care of the deities. And just read a couple, just because it's so nice. Oh, yeah, like his mind, he engaged his mind on the lotus feet of the Lord. And then the very last one that I was like, wow, because actually I was asked to give class about this. I think this was it that I gave class about. But and I didn't really notice this or like meditate upon this until I just read it the other day. The last one is, he engaged his desires in executing the mission of the Lord. Mm. So I just thought that that's such a good meditation, because it just shows whether you're living in the farm or whether you're living in the city, you know, we have to engage our desires in executing the mission. So that's what's so beautiful about, you know, you can follow your nature. You know, if you mm-hmm. are living in the city and that's, you know, you feel more natural there, or if you're living in the farm,
mm-hmm.
regardless, then the mission of the Lord, part of that is these farm communities, part of that is cow protection, sustainable living, and mm. the other part of that is preaching and telling people about Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you're living in the city and you can't execute that particular part of the mission, the very least you could do is preach and tell people about Krishna, because otherwise you're basically kind of just, I feel like it's kind of just... it's kind of just proving that maybe you're just living in the city because you're comfortable there and you're attached to those comforts.
Well, I appreciate that. You're a young person. When you have kids, the reality really changes. You have these dependent living entities, and your first responsibility is taking care of them. And it can be very challenging to do that, you know. So it's important that we keep an open mind and not... And by God's grace, we don't have to judge anybody. Thank goodness. It's such a burden relief. You know, people will all live in their own ways, and they'll serve Krishna in their own ways. And the quality of a devotee is that they always appreciate the Krishna consciousness of other devotees. That's one of the beautiful decorations of a Vaishnava. So, like, they see the good qualities, how this person is trying to serve Krishna in their circumstances. And some people, Sanat Goswami was saying to Haridas Thakur, some people preach, but they don't behave nicely. Some people behave nicely, but they don't preach. Because you both preach and behave nicely, you're the most advanced devotee in the world. So it may be that we can spread Krishna consciousness very effectively. It may be that we have to set that aside for 30 or for 20 years while we raise a family. And we spread Krishna consciousness by raising Krishna conscious children. You know, the good behavior means to appreciate how other devotees are serving Krishna. Like the gopis always, they have a competition who can serve Krishna better, but it's not like the competition in athletics. Who's number one? Everyone else is chopped liver. but rather, how nicely this devotee is serving Krishna. How can I help them? There's real excitement and joy in that experience. So I'm just cautioning you. You're young and you have an opportunity to do. The world is at your feet now. You can live in the country. You can live in the city. You can preach. You have all sorts of options. And not everybody is. I mean, your life won't always be like that, most likely. You know, there'll be things that come up that you'll need to set as priorities. So be very open-minded. That's all I'm saying. It's wonderful if devotees live in this country. It's wonderful if they live in the city and preach. And it's wonderful if they live in Alachua and raise a family. And they work at UPS and have deities in their home. So, all right. Yeah, like you said, Maharaj Ambarish. Savaimana Krishna Padaravindaya. He's always been thinking of the lotus feet of Krishna, wherever you may be. Is that right? Thank you. Srila Prabhupada.